Hello, you're listening to On the Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland right here on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Maddie Delplane.
I'm Grace Jenkins.
And I'm Akshay Kulkarni. It's Saturday, April the 24th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
This week, we're talking to the Drug User Liberation Front about an event they held last week to address the gaps in providing safe drug supply. We'll also be discussing the new COVID restrictions put in place by Premier John Horgan, Chinatown seniors who were saved from the brink of eviction, and the recent rankings of Canadian communities in Maclean's magazine.
But first, Maddie, tell us about your interview with Aris Nix.
Yeah, so I spoke with Aris Nix, who's one of the organizers with the Drug User Liberation Front. Last week, the Drug User Liberation Front coordinated an event called the No Compromise for Safe Supply, where they distributed free, tested, and clearly labeled boxes of cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin that was cut with caffeine to registered people over 18 years old who use drugs in the downtown east side.
That sounds great, but why did they need to do that?
Yeah, so back in September of 2020, Bonnie Henry had signed a public health order authorizing registered nurses to prescribe safe supply. But as you'll hear in the interview with Aris, this hasn't been nearly enough. So real life-saving solutions are still subject to lethal political delays and basically very patronizing policy approaches that largely ignore the realities faced by people who use drugs. I'll let Aris's interview explore those details. But for context, the TIE reported that since the beginning of the pandemic, 1,735 people died from the poison drug supply crisis in 2020, and that's 500 more people than those who have died from COVID-19. And that doesn't include the first few months of this year. I think we can all sometimes be guilty of getting kind of bogged down by these numbers and just these terrible notions of record-breaking overdose deaths. But I think it's important to remember that these are people in our community, their family members, their friends, and although it's an overwhelming situation, it is also, in the view of many, a hugely preventable loss of life. So in my conversation with Aris, she covers a lot of these topics, but I think one thing that's really clear is that people are grieving, they're horrified, and they're angry that in the 5 years since the toxic drug supply crisis was declared a public health emergency, BC is still losing an average of 5 people per day to the poisonous drug supply. Before we play the interview, I just wanted to emphasize again that for those who are interested in supporting the Drug User Liberation Front and the work that they do, you can go to www.dulf.ca.
All right, sounds good. Let's take a listen.
Yeah, can you just tell me what exactly the Drug User Liberation Front is and what it is that you guys do?
We're an unincorporated organization of different drug user groups, by and for drug user groups, nothing that's state sanctioned. Our mandate is to try and provide people with safe, clean drugs by any means necessary. I think we're trying to fill in a massive gap in the continuum of care, where things just have kind of fallen off the radar. You know, everyone's dead from overdose, and the only thing that's going to prevent that is if people can get access to clean and safe drugs. And I think it is about preventing death by providing people drugs with a predictable content, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you tell me a little bit about the event, the No Compromise for Safe Supply, that you all organized last week?
What we did was provide people in the downtown east side who were over the age of 18, who are drug users, with access to clean methamphetamine, clean cocaine, and heroin cut with caffeine. So that's 40% heroin, 60% caffeine. We used a informed consent compassion club model. I think the point was to demonstrate that the answer is right there. It's super easy, super straightforward, and sometimes the simplest answers, which are correct, are also the hardest to digest. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this wasn't the first time that you all had set up a table like this, from what I understand, right?
We've done three events. The first time we only gave out cocaine. The second time was more clandestine because we were providing fentanyl. And the third time, which was hyper-publicized. Obviously, we gave out the three classical hard drugs. I think the point, the reason people overdose, period, is because if you're shooting a 10 paper of heroin one day, and it is 90% fentanyl, and then the next day it's 30%, and then the day after that it goes back to 90. The volatility in the content of your drugs is going to cause you to overdose and die, because you're going to expect, you need to, inject the same volume of drugs in your body to just get just as high as the previous day. So to us, we're trying to rectify this issue, this policy failure that is the regime of prohibition through demonstration. I mean, obviously, I'm just like, at what point do the police arrest us? I thought fully 100% I was going to go to jail, and I'm not, sitting in a cell. So how much can you scale up the model before it becomes a problem? Because we know it works. Nobody overdosed on the drugs we gave anyone, as far as I'm concerned. Or understand or know. So, and we had an overdose prevention site set up. We had drug checking set up at the event.
Yeah. What kind of does go into like organizing something like this, like as far as like supply and then also, I guess, legal considerations, as you'd said?
I mean, we had three lawyers. All the drugs we get, we source off the dark web. But I'm just like, I don't know, everything's everyone's fucking dead. Five people in BC die a day. And I'm like, the only answer is get them clean drugs. And the government's not going to do that. So we do that. We get them off the dark web. We buy them with cryptocurrency, and then we give them out for free. It's a very straightforward answer to a fucking ridiculous problem that's been going on for 5 years solid.
Yeah. And I know, like, as you know, Dr. Bonnie Henry had issued this like public health order back in September, authorizing nurses to distribute safe supply. But I mean, clearly that's not actually accessible.
Bonnie Henry can f*** off. And I'm like, I'm on that safe supply program. I still use illicit street drugs.
Yeah.
You know? I'm like, you can't get high on the safe supply. It's not safe supply. Safe supply entails you can get as much of it whenever you want and use it however you want to. What we have right now, the extension of the continuum of care is you can go get, eight dilaudid aids or whatever, speed pills, Dexedrine, Adderall, Ritalin. It's a farce because, if you're someone who's smoking side crystal meth every day, or if you're smoking crack, I'm like, you can't smoke extended release Dexedrine. Dilaudid's not the same thing as heroin, certainly not the same thing as fentanyl. And now they're cutting off they're cutting off everyone's carries of their drugs, blah, 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 meaning that all these people that had these scripts, like, I'm pretty sure the College of Physicians left the table because they were like, everyone's diverting their drugs and we're done prescribing, these highly addictive drugs. This isn't the answer. It's ineffective. And I'm like, the reason it's ineffective isn't because safe supply as a concept works. It's because you're not giving people what they want. So of course they're going to divert their drugs. If they want fentanyl, they're going to divert their drugs to get fentanyl.
Yeah, absolutely. And can you, I guess, sort of break down for me, like, what an event like this is doing and then what you're hoping to see more from the government?
I expect the government will just keep colonially murdering people and this genocide. I don't expect the government to do anything. If anything, I expect them to redact, some of the more progressive policies they've put in place or whatever. I think what we're demonstrating is we know how to fix a problem. And if they're not going to like let us do it in a legal way, we'll just have to do it illegally until something gives. Or we'll all go to jail. Or, be murdered by whatever criminal organizations also don't want us to do this. The whole situation is like beyond FUBAR'd. So I don't trust, the government's not going to do shit. I've worked for the government. I've worked for the BC CDC. Everyone there's a fucking idiot.
You've already touched on a lot of these, but what are some of like the biggest obstacles currently in the way between like basically organizations, what you're trying to do, and then like the legitimate wide availability of safe supply?
To provide a Schedule I drug, it's like mandatory minimum to what we did was traffic Schedule I drugs. That's mandatory minimum 2 years if you're arrested. Mm-hmm. Why the cops didn't arrest us? Was it just because it was a one-off thing? Whatever, whatever. You know, there are drug user groups that run compassion clubs successfully. Mm-hmm. But it's all clandestine. No one's doing it above board. And so long as people don't have, you know, there's a reason we can have liquor legislation and regulation to prevent people from drinking, you know, ethyl alcohol or whatever and going blind or damaging their stomach lining. I'm like, no one asks you if you have a drinking disorder when you go to the liquor store, and there's no restriction on how much hard liquor you can buy. Mm-hmm. I'm like, the entire system front to back is f***ed up and no one wants to fix it because I'm like, it's so connected to the prison industrial complex and the medical industrial complex. I'm just like having constant violent surveillance over indigenous populations and other communities of color. So at the end of the day, you're f***ed. I'm like, all this demonstrated to us is that we know what we're doing and how to do it, but you know, we're never going to get any kind of state sanctioned backing. So everything's always high risk, low reward for us, which I feel like, you know, is intentional. And that's just the way this game has got to be played. It's horrible. It's horrific. The monumental amount of stress and anyone that's at risk in this. Like, I'm like, we have three fucking lawyers. Do you know how much a human rights lawyer costs? Like $500 an hour. Where the fuck are we getting this money? We're all poor idiots.
Yeah, where are you guys getting funding? Is it mostly donation-based or...?
Mostly. I mean, we have like, if you go on heroinmart.com, we're selling like, you know, swag. We fundraise a lot of money through swag. The cryptocurrency market has also, you know, relatively been working out in their favor. Mm-hmm. Ostensibly, I'm just like, we're f***ed. Everybody dies. That's it.
Yeah. You referenced something called the Compassion Club model. Can you explain that a little bit more?
The idea is just that if you're a drug user, you know, and whatever other stipulations they want to put on it, could be geographic, could be a membership model, could be an age-based model, whatever, mm-hmm. you become a member of this thing as a drug user, and they compassionately sell you drugs to prevent you from overdosing and dying. It's the same thing as a marijuana compassion club. And if like your listenership really wants to know, there's a document called the, you know, BCCSU. If you go on dolph.ca, www.dolph.ca, all these in the resources section, all these documents have been posted. So basic idea is though, is that you're just selling people drugs, clean drugs on a membership based model, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is there anything, I mean, obviously this only touched on like a part of this, but is there something else that you think I missed that you want to add?
Not really, no.
Okay. And if anybody wants to support you guys at all and, you know, add to your efforts, donate, something like that, is there somewhere that I can direct people to go?
Yeah, we have, you know, cryptocurrency, legal defense, and just like direct e-transfer donations on our website, www.dolph.ca. Again, you can buy merchandise from heroinmart.com. Obviously we don't sell drugs on the website. We don't sell drugs. We're not drug dealers. I'm just like, in the eyes of the law, we're drug dealers, you know. Mm-hmm. All the drugs we've ever given out have always been free.
Yeah,
that's it.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, no worries. You have a great day.
Thanks, you too. See ya.
Bye.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies. Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
ATIRA Women's Resource Society supports women and children impacted by violence by building and operating a range of safe, affordable housing and related support services, including childcare centers. ATIRA has housing and programs across the Lower Mainland. Our feminism is inclusive and intersectional. We envision a world free of inequalities where everyone's human rights are respected and where women and girls have the right to participate fully and effectively in all of the decisions that affect their lives. To find out how you can help, please visit our website at atira.bc.ca or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Free of Violence.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
That's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlach, Chairman.
Welcome back to On the Point, the news show right here on CITR 101.9 FM. You just listened to an interview with Aris Nix of the Drug User Liberation Front about the need for stronger safe supply after their No Compromise for Safe Supply event last week.
Before we end the show, let's talk about the new BC travel restrictions. These restrictions are targeting recreational travel between areas in the province. BC residents are being asked not to travel outside of their health regions for non-essential purposes. These regions are Lower Mainland and Fraser Valley, Northern Interior, and Vancouver Island. These rules will be in effect until midnight on June 25th, and there's a $575 fine for breaking these rules. My question for all of you are, will these restrictions be effective? Do you think they're going far enough or too far?
I have a lot of things to say about this. First, that like it sounds like it's too little too late, especially with how the virus has been spreading, especially to like isolated communities in the northern part of the province and to the island and stuff like that. But on the flip side of this, imposing such restrictions takes a lot of enforcement. And I think when these restrictions were first announced by Premier John Horgan, there was this really like throwaway line where he's like, we consulted with BIPOC people about this, because as we know, random police checks, which is what this was initially set out to be before they set out the guidance around the fact that you can travel within your designated health region. Random street checks are hugely negatively impact Indigenous people and Black people. So this came I think a mere like 2 days after Doug Ford over in Ontario did the exact same thing and got a lot of blowback for this idea of random street checks. So on one hand, I'm like, yes, this makes sense to me, and enforcement of this is going to after the clarification, makes a lot more sense to me. But the fact that we had to wait for the VPD, the Vancouver Police Department, to say, hey, we don't want to enforce these things, what do you feel about it, is not a position that people should be in, especially when we're in month 13 of this pandemic. Like, people are, like, teetering on the edge here. And when you add the potential to be randomly street checked for going to the supermarket or whatever, to the lives of marginalized people, hugely negatively impacted by this, it's just disgusting, I'll be honest with you. And I mean, the clarifications have been necessary and I'm glad they've come, but like, it's just such a bad look. It's just not good policy when it's so confusing and when it's so potentially disastrous. And yeah, I don't know. I just don't know.
Do you think that the fines in place, the $575 fine, will be enough to deter anti-maskers and the like? People who just aren't caring about the restrictions that are already in place?
I mean, no. I don't know exactly how to typecast who specifically anti-maskers are, but like, by and large, the people that are going to actually suffer from a $575 fine for anything are people who are already living like in extreme poverty and might be the demographics who are going to be more subjected to street checks in the first place. So I don't know. I feel like anti-maskers are going to be digging their heels in no matter what. I don't think that for somebody who's, say, like more comfortable, like middle income, like $575 is annoying, but it's also like, A, not guaranteed that it's going to be enforced on everyone unilaterally or consistently. And it's also like not a big enough fine that like would be offensive to people who are making, say, like $40,000 to $60,000 a year. But like, I don't know. In any case, I'm not saying that the fine should necessarily be higher. I'm just saying that $575 seems like kind of a pointless amount to assign to deter the anti-masking demographic, if you will.
And this also comes after like, I don't know if you all saw this report where the mandatory hotel quarantine that all travelers through IVR were being asked to do was, I believe it was $2,000 if you did the quarantine, which you were supposed to do, but it's also like $2,000 per day if of the quarantine if you didn't follow it, and like a significant chunk of passengers were not quarantining and they were just paying the fine. So like, yeah, I feel like the people who are going to be rule breakers about this, I don't know if there's any sort of demographic study on them, but there's quite a significant amount who are doing it because they can, for lack of a better word. So
do we want to move on to the next question? Okay. All right. So the BC government has purchased a Chinatown seniors home in Vancouver for $17 million in an effort to prevent residents from being evicted and provide culturally appropriate services. This was revealed after local news organizations published stories of families left scrambling to find new accommodations for seniors who were given the impression that they would be evicted as a result of the sale. What do you think it says about the province's commitments to social housing? What are your thoughts?
It must be so like scary in the middle of a pandemic to like, especially given a lot of these seniors that we're talking about don't understand English and they're like 80, 90 plus years old. It must be so scary to see a newspaper report that you're going to be evicted and not even see anything else. So for some context, the owner of the property, I believe sold it to a nonprofit who's working with BC Housing. And then there was a newspaper report about him wanting to like move into another site in Renfrew, and then that's what prompted the alarm over evictions. But BC Housing has now bought the property outright, and you know they don't have intermediaries, and now it's going to be managed by Success, which is an organization that works with a lot of Chinatown seniors. That's good, I guess, but like the fact that there were all of these hoops that the seniors had to jump through of their own accord, like it's not like they signed up for any of this like unnecessary pain, again, as I said earlier, in month 13 of a global pandemic, it's pretty wild. And this is closely related to what happened in the budget last week with the province's budget announced by Serena Robinson, the finance minister, and in that there's not too much commitment to social housing really. There's a 10% increase over the next 2 years, I believe, which really isn't too much considering how the housing crisis in the province and how many homeless people experiencing homelessness that we have, it's just not good. And also it's not directly being provided to like nonprofit providers. It's being provided to developers who can choose to take on these loans and grants in order to build these nonprofit housing. But that's made like increasingly difficult by the fact that housing is just so expensive here that there was a study by the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives that showed that even if you built the most efficient housing block that you could, you'd still have to rent it at a $1,700 a month in order to make back costs, let alone make any sort of operating profit. So yeah, it's not a good situation, to put it lightly. And correlated with the fact that there's an eviction crisis, there's no eviction bans, and there's no paid sick leave, another big thing that wasn't in the budget. Just a very weird provincial stance on affordable housing in general. It's like the most left-leaning party not committing to a policy of incrementalism. So I guess we will just move on then to something lighter and perhaps more entertaining than my rants over the past 10 minutes. So Maclay's magazine does this thing where they rank communities in Canada, and they've just published their latest ranking. And in something that was quite surprising to me, and apparently a lot of other people living in Vancouver, Vancouver is ranked 174th out of 415. This is especially stark given almost all of the other big cities in Canada are like in the top 50, top 20 at least. There's a very detailed methodology for why this is the case, like property costs and like crime and all sorts of stuff like that. But it was just very surprising to me. A couple of things that are very interesting. First, there are other communities in BC that are on this list. And Kamloops is in number 37, way above Vancouver. Delta is number 48. North Van is in 58. And West Van is 168th. So, I mean, that's fine, I guess. But like also Greater Vancouver is also on this list. And that is at 342nd. So like, I don't understand how this makes sense. I looked at the methodology and it says, we count a community as a census subdivision, but is that a community? Is North Van as much a community as Vancouver itself? I don't know. So my first question, and I think the biggest question, is do you think Vancouver should have been higher?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because I like Vancouver, and obviously my opinion is completely accurate and not biased in the slightest.
Good answer.
I may have only lived in one city in Canada, but I can absolutely accurately say that Vancouver should have been higher on this list.
I think it's a bigger question about what even counts as a community, right? Like, Vancouver is a pretty big city. I would hazard a guess and say that neighborhoods they're not drastically different, but some of them are pretty different. Like, Chinatown is very, very different from the West End, right? Are those communities, or do they contribute to a larger community? Like, who can say?
I'd also say that probably UBC is a different community than downtown Vancouver. So, yeah, I don't know. I'd be interested to know, like, how they decided, like, what counts as a community. And, like, why they chose those particular distinctions.
It's a very detailed methodology that you can look up, but it's way too long, I'll be honest. But yeah.
I think it was, I don't know if you've gone over this, but I think it was like based on like municipal boundaries, in which case it kind of does make sense. I mean, it's hard for me to, oh, there was a shrug there. Okay. You want to elaborate on that shrug or should I keep going? Okay, I'll keep going. It's hard for me personally to feel like very offended about seeing this list. Because it's just like it's a list, you know. What does it actually matter? I mean, you know, I'm sure there are like broader social political implications of this list, but also like as someone, you know, I think like it's you know, I'm all for criticizing Vancouver because I feel like that's how change happens instead of trying to pretend that we're like the best. And like in terms of like looking at like housing prices, like the average value, so if you click into it, you know, there's the average value of primary real estate, and it's like it's 1 million, it's more than a million. And like if you click into any of the other ones, it's like I'm trying to do the math, like 200k, 300k, like absolutely insane. So honestly, power to McLean's. You know what? Rip Vancouver a new one. I don't care.
Mari, I think you had a point to make.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm still kind of trying to figure out like their system for their like criteria for a lot of these. But I don't know. Again, obviously, I feel like the community involvement metric seems really arbitrary and kind of bizarre. But in my like fairly unscientific way of thinking about this, like whenever you like, this is purely anecdotal, but usually whenever like housing affordability goes down, like when you have like a very high like income threshold that you have to pass in order to survive in a place, typically community engagement will go down. Like people become like hyper individualistic. They're working all the time. And then when that happens, like people aren't really like bonding with their neighbors. And it's this very like hyper self-sufficient sort of, I don't know, way of living. So like, I don't know how much this is necessarily like reflected in this like breakdown, but like, I find that it can be sometimes a little bit challenging to forge community in a city like Vancouver if you are like part of the work environment, because yeah, there isn't a whole lot of necessarily like connectivity and codependency that happens within your community circles. But that's also like so variant depending on maybe where in the city you live and how you forge those community metrics. But like, I don't know, considering that the way that this was weighted also, I believe they give 19 points to housing affordability, which is like it's very large compared to like how they broke down the other metrics. Of course, Vancouver's going to rank low. Like, I feel like that's just a given. But yeah, anyways.
Yes. Was this peer reviewed?
Right.
Was there like did they follow the scientific method?
Not really. No, not at all. In fact, I completely agree. And I also think like the idea of like census subdivision being the place where you cut off a community is weird to me. Like, what is the border between Vancouver and North Van really mean? It's like a bridge. Like, what is the, is there a different person that I will meet on the other side of that bridge? Not really, right? It's like this weird extension of the border problem that we have like internationally to this very weird petty feud among communities. And yeah, I don't know where you define a community, even if it's super precise. Like, is my neighborhood a community? I don't know. I don't even know my neighbors. They have very nice cats, but and probably very friendly people, but like, I don't know them at all. Yeah, I'm a part of a community with them. I wouldn't go that far. So like, this is a list that is generated for social media buzz and just throat tearing, but I think it does raise some broader questions. And frankly, I think we devoted way too much time to it than it probably deserves. But blame the news cycle for that. Anyway, I think does anyone else have anything to say before we end off? Cool. Isa, take us out.
So that's our show for this week. You just listened to On the Point, CATR's news show. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 p.m. for more local news. Stay tuned for more great CATR programming.